Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture.
The headlines: Hezbollah proclaims victory over Israel, saying the delusional enemy failed to break the movement's resolve or diminish its willpower. The top commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps congratulates the Hezbollah chief for the resistance movement's victory over the Israeli regime. And the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees warns that hunger is reaching critical levels in Gaza, where people search for leftover food in the garbage. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story: ceasefire between Lebanon and Israel is now in its second day and largely upholding, yet there are reports of violations by the Tel Aviv regime. According to reports, Israeli artillery fired two shells at Yaruna village in southern Lebanon. Also, the regime restricted the Lebanese residents to enter 10 villages and their surroundings, warning that any entry could endanger their lives. A Lebanese lawmaker also reported the Israeli violation of the ceasefire in some areas. On Wednesday, ceasefire officially came into effect, setting the stage for an end to nearly 14 months of the Israeli aggression and Hezbollah's retaliatory operations. The deal will see the Israeli troops withdraw from southern Lebanon, with the Lebanese army redeploying in the region. Hezbollah will then move its assets to the north of the Litani River. The transition process is set to take place during a 60-day period. Lebanese citizens who were displaced during the Israeli aggression against their country have gradually been returning to their homes in the south following a ceasefire deal with the regime. Let's listen to some of the residents who expressed their feelings upon seeing their devastated homes and property.
We were in Beirut, but even if they gave me a castle in Beirut, I wouldn't give up my house here. Despite the destruction and the sadness and the fact that you can't even live in your house now, we are so happy that we returned home. And thank God we're all okay. We're not going anywhere. We're staying here. I'm going to fix it up. You saw me sweeping. I'm going to clean up and stay here. We can cover the windows with plastic or something. My children are here, their schools are here, and we're not going anywhere. We feel like our soul has returned.
We never expected to return and find Kana like this. We thought we'd come back and find everything as it was, and that we'd return to our homes and see our loved ones. But we lost a lot of people. We lost so many people we love, and so many people we love lost their homes. But thank God for everything. Coming back, that's the toughest part. To see the scenes we're seeing now, I don't know how we'll get used to living without those we were so close to.
Why do I care about my house? You see this destruction behind me? It is heartbreaking. So I'm asking around to see who doesn't have a home. They come stay with me. We'll all support each other. That's the way it is supposed to be.
Hezbollah says its resistance fighters showed their resilience over the past 1 year in the face of the Israeli aggression with thousands of retaliatory operations against the regime. Hezbollah said in a statement that its fighters conducted over 4,000 operations against Israeli positions in the occupied territories. It added more than 1,600 of these attacks were carried out since Israel's ground invasion of Lebanon 2 months ago. These operations targeted the regime's army bases as well as towns and cities in the occupied territories. The group said dozens of Israel's strategic and sensitive military facilities were attacked using ballistic precision-guided missiles and drones, causing numerous casualties among the regime's forces. The movement also destroyed a large number of Israeli tanks and military vehicles and brought down more than half a dozen advanced drones. Hezbollah emphasized that Israeli forces failed to occupy or establish control over any of the frontline Lebanese towns due to the steadfastness of resistance fighters. Well, Lebanese journalist Sanda Salassad joined us earlier with her take on the victory of the Hezbollah resistance movement at a ceasefire deal with the Israeli regime. Let's take a listen.
Hezbollah has joined the defensive war since the 8th of October 2023. Ever since, Hezbollah has been launching heroic operations against Zionist occupation in defense of the Palestinian people and in defense of the sovereignty of the Lebanese land. The resistance has been facing not only the Zionist proxy, but the entire Western imperialist powers who have been aiding and giving the Israeli colonial entity unconditional assistance, whether on the military level or on the diplomatic level. They thought that they can, as they claimed in their media and in the statements of their officials, that they can eliminate Hezbollah because they don't know or they try to ignore the fact that what makes Hezbollah is the people, the righteous indigenous people of the West, of the South, and of Bekaa, of various Lebanese land. Those resistance fighters are the indigenous inhabitants of this land, and they won't accept that their land be attacked on a daily basis by the Zionist occupation.
The chief commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has congratulated Hezbollah's secretary general over the resistance movement's victory against the Israeli aggression against Lebanon. In a message to Sheikh Naim Rasa, Major General Hossein Salami said the ceasefire in Lebanon is, quote, a strategic and humiliating defeat for the Zionist regime. Salami said the Israeli military did not even come close to achieving any of its evil goals, aspirations, and desires in the war against Hezbollah. He noted that accepting a ceasefire amid the barrage of Hezbollah missiles targeting strategic Israeli positions was a big lesson for the regime. The top commander stressed that the ceasefire is an indication, especially for what he called the Zionist criminal gang and the rabid dog of the U.S. in the region, that the era of the regime's decline is underway. General Salami expressed hope that the ceasefire in Lebanon could mark the beginning of a truce and the end of the war in Gaza. More death and destruction in Gaza as the Israeli military is pressing ahead with its attacks across the blockaded territory. In one of the attacks, Israeli warplanes struck two homes in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza, killing at least four people and injuring several more. To the south of Gaza, a drone strike killed a number of civilians in Khan Yunis. Over 1 year of Israeli attacks on Gaza have claimed nearly 44,300 lives and injured some 105,000 others. The U.S. Israeli genocide has pushed the blockaded territory to a breaking point, with international aid agencies voicing concern over catastrophic humanitarian situation there. The U.N. Agency for Palestinian Refugees has warned of repercussions of hunger across Gaza, saying it's reaching critical levels. The International Committee of the Red Cross also issued a similar warning, calling a humanitarian situation in Gaza unacceptable. Elsewhere, 10-year-old Bana Jibril is a young artist who paints portraits of pro-Palestinian figures from around the globe. She has been displaced in Gaza numerous times. She ultimately escaped the horrors of war to Egypt. International support is precious to her, giving her hope that the ongoing genocide soon. Abu Bakr Abed reports from Gaza's central city of Deir al-Bala.
Bana spends hours with her father expressing her love and appreciation for pro-Palestinian figures through her paintings. After leaving Gaza for Egypt last May, following multiple forced displacements from her home in the Sheikh Ridwan neighborhood, she now finds solace and hope in her digital art, which she uses to convey a message to the world. As her dreams were crushed like those of all children in Gaza, she hopes her paintings will inspire more people to stand in solidarity with Gaza and help in the genocide.
Drawing is my passion. It makes me so happy and gives me hope. My dad is my hero because he helped me how to draw, and my dad and I draw people support Palestine.
Bana's family is now stuck in Egypt after losing everything in Gaza. They believe their daughter's future has been destroyed, but insist on supporting her in every way they can, while hoping to set foot in their homeland once again.
During the war on Gaza, I lost my work. When we were forced to leave Gaza, I had to use my and my daughter's talent in drawing, which turned to be our source of income to some extent. I'm always trying to support my daughter and help and motivate her to draw, because she may represent the Palestine cause on the local and world stage through her quill and crayons.
Like all children in Gaza, Bana once had a life brimming with joy and love, as she dreamed of becoming a famous artist one day. She was fortunate to escape the fate of the 17,000 children who were killed in Gaza. Her talent blossomed in the besieged territory, but Israel destroyed her home, her school, and all her dreams.
Pain inspires art and talent. Bana is a gifted young artist who, at the age of 10, uses her remarkable art to inspire the world to support Gaza. Her message, like that of all children in the worst-stricken territory, is a plea for peace, a dream she wishes the world will help make a reality. Abu Bakr Abed, Deir al-Bala, Gaza.
Israeli protesters have once again poured onto the streets of occupied Al-Quds, demanding an immediate deal for the release of captives in Gaza. The demonstrators slammed Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his far-right cabinet for failing to secure a captive swap deal with Hamas. Nearly 1,000 people attended the rally to demand a ceasefire similar to one established with Lebanon. Israeli security forces arrested some of the protesters. A group of protesters also gathered in front of the Ministry of Military Affairs in Tel Aviv, slamming what they called a humiliating defeat in Lebanon. Palestinian resistance groups have expressed desire for a ceasefire, but insisted they would not submit to pressures if the deal did not meet their conditions. On Wednesday, senior Hamas official Sami Abu Zohri accused Israel of being inflexible in talks to reach a truce.
We're now demonstrating because we see that
Iran has condemned accusations leveled against the country by the G7 foreign ministers, saying they arise from the group's unjust, biased, and unilateral approaches. Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei was referring to a G7 summit condemning Iran's October missile attack on Israel and accusing Tehran of destabilizing West Asia. He said issues that the Western-dominated bloc blames on Iran are in fact the consequences of the West's own misguided policies. Baghaei said the G7 has adopted an irresponsible and unethical policy by ignoring the crimes of Israel and the regime in the region while shifting the blame onto victims. He stressed that Iran is entitled to respond to the Zionist regime's aggression against its national sovereignty and territorial integrity based on its inherent right to self-defense. Baghaei reaffirmed that Iran remains committed to its responsibility to ensure regional security and stability and will spare no effort in this regard. Researcher and political commentator Christopher Halali joined us earlier with his take on accusations leveled against Iran by the Group of Seven. Let's take a listen.
My take on this is that Iran, once again, has established deterrence. It continues to try to seek peace and peaceful settlements in the region. However, it understands that it is not the source of the growing instability and the war and ongoing genocide we have been seeing for over a year. It is the G7 countries that are supporting the belligerent powers, most notably the Zionist entity, who continue to destabilize the region and continue to sow death and destruction to tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people. And of course, we know over the past 20 years, it has been the United States and its European allies in NATO that have sown the seeds and killed millions from Iraq, from Lebanon, from Syria, from Afghanistan, Yemen, and elsewhere in the region, Libya. So, of course, we understand, and I think the Iranian foreign ministry spokesman, Mr. Baghai, is correct to assert that it is not Iran's responsibility for this ongoing chaos. It is firmly in the camp of the G7, and especially the United States and the European allies of the United States, who are the main source of this with their ongoing support for the Zionist entity and for regional powers who continue to destabilize the region.
In India, surveys of centuries-old mosques are sparking outrage among the Muslim community, with one survey turning into deadly communal violence in Uttar Pradesh. Authorities have recently begun evaluating whether mosques were built on raised Hindu temples during the Mughal rule. A similar controversy over a 16th-century mosque sparked deadly violence after right-wing Hindu mobs destroyed it in 1992, and later the Apex Court gave a verdict in favor of Hindus to build a temple there. Munawar Zaman has the story.
Places of worship have been highly sensitive in the Indian subcontinent since the 1947 partition. In India, disputes over them are frequently exploited for political gain, playing on voter sentiments. On Sunday, a survey of the centuries-old Grand Mosque in Uttar Pradesh Sambal district sparked deadly clashes, claiming 5 lives. Hindu groups claim the mosque was built on a destroyed temple during Mughal rule, while Muslim groups are fighting related legal cases in various courts. In recent years, Hindu groups in many states have filed numerous lawsuits alleging that mosques were built on raised Hindu temples during the Mughal era.
Sunday's incident has reignited fears of violence over a sensitive religious dispute in the world's most populous nation, which is marred by the history of communal carnage after the partition of India in 1947, at the end of British rule.
Hindu activists and groups many affiliated with Prime Minister Modi's ruling party claim several mosques were built on the sites of centuries-old Hindu temples raised by the Mughal Empire. Observers note these groups have grown bolder since the recent inauguration of a controversial Hindu temple built on the site of a Babri mosque in Ayodhya, destroyed by a Hindu mob on December 6, 1992. Muslim groups denounce this as a violation of the Places of Worship Act 1991, despite lower courts ordering such surveys, and are calling for Supreme Court intervention.
This drive has been ongoing since the demolition of the Babri mosque. It's been a deliberate political agenda since 1990. Unfortunately, even the court judgment failed to serve justice, despite the lack of evidence proving the Babri Mosque was built after raising a temple. This is all a political conspiracy by communal forces.
Prominent Muslim scholars condemned the recent violence, calling it a clear example of lawlessness, injustice and cruelty. Activists echoed this sentiment, stating that the ruling party aims to reduce Muslims to second-class citizens with limited civil liberties, unable to even protest for their constitutionally guaranteed fundamental rights.
We have to understand that these are essential elements of the ideology of Bharatiya Janata Party, and all these acts are aimed at marginalizing Muslims and criminalizing all aspects of their life and to restrain their living. That is the ideology of Bharatiya Janata Party. We have to understand it, and therefore we call it fascism.
Rights activists and observers say that since the ruling party came to power in 2014, Muslims have faced systematic repression, including hate speeches, hate crimes, mob lynching, the new citizenship law, and now the push for a uniform civil code and the seizure of Muslim charitable properties, Waqf. Activists say the aim is to disempower Muslims as a part of a larger political agenda to create a unified Hindu-first India. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
In the limelight.
Mere denunciation of the evil minds such as the chief crime minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his now replaced war minister, the coward called Yoav Gallant, who together are responsible for the death of at least 45,000 people in Gaza and another 4,000 in Lebanon, is neither implementation of justice nor punishment of the bloodthirsty criminals. The only solution is announcing the death sentence, and it's carrying out without any delay and waste of time and energy in unnecessary trials when the evidence against the war criminals is clear. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Kayhan International wrote, "Are arrest warrants enough to deter war criminals from ending their slaughter of innocent men, women and children with abandon and bombing of towns to rubble? Has the International Court of Justice ever done justice to the victims and their bereaved families by summoning mass murderers to attend court proceedings? What punishment has the International Criminal Court handed to the killers of humanity in order to prevent others in the future from committing genocide?" These questions, asked by the world people, aghast at the 14th month's genocide in Gaza and unfolding of the organized massacre in Lebanon by the illegal Zionist entity with the full support of the super criminal, the U.S., and its continued supply of the most lethal weapons, demand decisive answers. Mere denunciation of the evil minds such as the chief crime minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his now replaced war minister, the coward called Yoav Gallant, who together are responsible for the death of at least 45,000 people in Gaza and another 4,000 in Lebanon, is neither implementation of justice nor punishment of the bloodthirsty criminals. The only solution is announcing the death sentence, and it's carrying out without any delay and waste of time and energy in unnecessary trials when the evidence against the war criminals is clear. This is what the leader of the Islamic Revolution said recently in his address to a large gathering in Tehran, telecast nationally and internationally. "The ICC arrest warrant is not enough. Netanyahu's death sentence must be ordered," he said amid vociferous chants of "God's greatness, Allahu Akbar," interspersed with shouts of "Death to Israel and death to the U.S. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, referring to Israel's aggression in the Gaza Strip and Lebanon, pointed out that the bombing of residential buildings is not a victory, but a crime. He added that the cowardly enemy has not won its wars in Gaza and Lebanon, and it will never be able to do so. It is now interesting to see which of the 124 countries that signed the Rome Statute establishing the ICC have the courage to arrest the bloodthirsty Zionist pair if they step foot in any one of them. Super Terrorist US is not a signatory to the ICC and is about to trample international laws by hosting the former Zionist war minister, who should be dispatched to the bowels of hell by the justice-loving American people in defense of humanitarian values. Even in occupied Palestine, persons craving for justice and opposed to the war ought to make short work of Netanyahu. If in the meantime a drone or a missile fired by any of the factions of the Axis of Resistance does not snuff out his devilish life. Meanwhile, Crescent International wrote, it took the International Criminal Court in The Hague 6 months to issue arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant for war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza. In the six-month period since May 2024, the Zionist war criminals have murdered tens of thousands of other Palestinians, the vast majority of them women and children. They have also displaced 2.3 million Palestinians, the entire population of Gaza, and subjected them to starvation. Food, water, and medicines have been deliberately withheld from the Palestinians to force them out of the tiny enclave. This is meant to implant Zionist squatters in Gaza on a permanent basis. The court unanimously rejected challenges by Israel under Articles 18 and 19 of the Rome Statute. It said in a statement, the court said it found reasonable grounds to believe that Netanyahu and Gallant each bear criminal responsibility for the following crimes as co-perpetrators for committing the acts jointly with others: the war crime of starvation as a method of warfare, and the crimes against humanity of murder, persecution, and other inhuman acts. The official death toll in Gaza has surpassed 45,000 since October 7, 2023, while 103,000 Palestinians have been injured. The actual death toll, according to a study by the British medical journal The Lancet, may be as high as 186,000. Even as these lines are being written, the Zionists are continuing their genocidal campaign in Gaza. So, as far as the Zionist war criminals are concerned, the ICC arrest warrant will not deter them from continuing their genocide of the Palestinians. They slaughtered another 90 Palestinians, many of them children, by bombing the Beit Lahia camp in North Gaza on November 21st. The Dutch news agency ANP, citing the country's foreign minister, Kasper Veldkamp, reported that the Netherlands is prepared to act upon the arrest warrant issued by the ICC against Netanyahu if needed. If the Israeli regime leader comes to Dutch soil, he will be arrested, Veldkamp said in the House of Representatives local outlet Nos reported. The ICC is based in The Hague, the Netherlands. The foreign minister said the Netherlands implements the Rome Statute 100%. The signatories of the Rome Statute and members of the ICC are bound to arrest those against whom warrants are issued. The EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, was equally emphatic, saying that the ICC decision was not political and should be respected and implemented. The French, however, prevaricated. When asked at a news conference if France would arrest Netanyahu, Foreign Ministry spokesperson Christophe Lemoine said it was a legally complicated question. What was legally complicated about it when the ICC ruled that it found reasonable grounds that Netanyahu and Gallant were criminally responsible for mass starvation and murder? The Islamic resistance movement Hamas welcomed the arrest warrants issued by the ICC. Hamas political bureau member Mohsen Naim said in a statement, it is an important step towards justice and can lead to redress for the victims in general, but it remains limited and symbolic if it is not supported by all means by all countries around the world. It is yet to be seen whether the two Zionist war criminals will be arrested and brought in handcuffs to The Hague.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. A much-anticipated ceasefire has kicked into effect in Lebanon between the resistance movement Hezbollah and the Israeli regime. Over 14 months of cross-border clashes, followed by an extreme escalation of hostilities late September, may finally have come to an end. What was this conflict all about? What is a ceasefire all about? And which side achieved its objectives? And which side goes to bed tonight a little more fatigued, beleaguered, and defeated? How did Israel kill more people, ruin more infrastructure, but walks off the battlefield tonight far from victor and much closer to shamed and isolated more than ever? And these are the questions we will ask in this installment of Spotlight. Our guest, Mr. Hami, academic and political analyst, joining us from Lebanese capital, Beirut. And Laith Maarouf, activist and political commentator, joining us from South Lebanon. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we'll start there with you in Beirut, Mr. Ali Hami. Hope you're having a good evening out there. Tell us, let's begin, start at the beginning, what the mood you feel like is right now in Beirut following the first day of the implementation of the ceasefire. Let's start at the beginning as well on why Hezbollah in October of last year started engaging occupation forces along the southern Lebanese border.
Greetings for you and for your guest and for all the audience. Let's say that it's a victorious day, even though we lost our leader and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and the other leaders for military leaders also. But still, and so many martyrs, and we still can hold our hands up for victory, because we first prevent the enemy from achieve any of his achievements or goals or elements that he declared at the beginning of the war against Lebanon. At the beginning, Hezbollah was supporting the Gaza Strip to lift the embargo and the genocide that Israel is still committing against the Palestinian and as most of the resistance axis. Then later on, the Israelis turned on against Lebanon with more than five divisions and try to destroy Lebanon, and they warned us and threatened us, the Israelis, to first enter Lebanon, to demolish Lebanon, to invade Lebanon. Then they returned to the maneuvering and also trying to say incursion or so. So they went back in their high roof requirements and conditions. First, they said, we will not cease fire until the destroying Hezbollah, then disarmament of Hezbollah, freedom of movements inside Lebanon, and then later on, they said after the killing of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, they said they want new Middle East, and they want to change the Middle East so to be under their management. This, nothing happened from what they declared at the beginning of their aggression against Lebanon. The battlefield in the south proved that Lebanon is strong, Hezbollah is strong, and he became stronger and stronger every day after healing of all, and after all the healing efforts were completed, and the day 24/11 was a day to remember against the Israelis, and it's a switch the Israelis from thinking of imposing condition against Lebanon to go begging the American to do and to implement the 1701 without a resolution, without any preconditions.
Thank you, Mr. Hamia, for your initial input there. Leif Maruf, welcome to the conversation. Hope you're having a good evening out there, and congratulations to you and the Lebanese people for this ceasefire. Leif, some say, but Hezbollah's job is to protect Lebanese soil and the Lebanese people. Why fight for the Gazans? How do you respond to that?
Because, number one, there is the religious requirement to support those who are oppressed that Muslims have. And, of course, there's the other fact that Palestine and Lebanon and Syria and Jordan were all created through cutting these countries away from each other during the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the World War I, which created the Zionist colony. So in reality, the Lebanese people, the Palestinian people, the Syrian people are all one, and these borders are artificial. And of course, finally, killing the Palestinian peoples, oppressing them, and the Palestinians never reaching their liberation would mean also that the Lebanese people would be next, the Syrian people would be next, everybody in the region will be next. So liberation of Palestine will lead to the liberation of the Lebanese people, the Syrian people, the whole region from Western imperialism that has dogged us for 100 years now and have cut off the region, killed so many thousands upon thousands over the last 100 years, and destroyed all the natural resources in the region. Lebanon was trying to save itself by supporting the Palestinian people, and any Arabic people that didn't come to the aid of the Palestinian people, any Muslim people that didn't come to the aid of the Palestinian people, are setting themselves up for the same fate as the Palestinian people, to be oppressed by the West, to have their resources looted, and to have our religion and our cultures desecrated.
Thank you. And Mr. Hamia, you made an interesting point, an interesting statement, actually. You said they tried to destroy Lebanon. Now, the leadership in Tel Aviv said that we're going to go and cripple Hezbollah. We're going to take them out, just like they said their objective was in Gaza, to cripple Hezbollah's military capabilities. But here we have the statistics, 67 attacks on hospitals, 231 attacks on emergency medical services. Attacks led to the deaths of 222 health sector workers and injured more than 330 people. 40 hospitals are damaged. Eight of them have been rendered completely non-functional. A total of 251 emergency vehicles have been damaged. To your point, this does not seem like going after an objective against Hezbollah, but rather civilian population and Lebanon's civilian infrastructure by the Zionist entity.
It's a massive killing, and it's a genocide against people, against infrastructure, against civilian infrastructure, against the agriculture, against the hospitals, schools, churches, mosques, against the humanity. But the most important question is, when he asked and he tried to impose his high roof ceiling conditions, and at the beginning, most of the people, the entity people, asked Netanyahu not to go for a war on the north. and he did. Now, most of the settlers are asking him not to stop before they return, and he stopped. So there is some kind of craziness and stupidity in his strategy. Let's say the main question is, what the enemy prime minister will answer his people now if they ask him, show us your achievements. What did you achieve? Let's see what goals were achieved by your doing a war and aggression against Lebanon. And what goals did you achieve against Gaza if the POWs, no exchange for them, Hamas still fighting, no tunnels found. So it means Netanyahu went back to the first square, and he cannot answer such questions. I think the Zionist entity is now living in a dilemma, in contradiction, war of contradiction again between them, and I think Netanyahu will not have any answer to respond for them, to response, and he will be confused, because I think moving from one priority to another, and from one goal to another, from one front to another, and not achieving, as he mentioned before to his people, that he will have a victorious day after killing so many people in Gaza and in Lebanon and destroying all this civilian infrastructure. I think he will be paralyzed to answer any of those questions. What that means, that he is in the corner. He cannot defend himself against the international criminal court or the local criminal court. He has no strong hold points to defend himself against any accusations.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
And Laith Maruf, I'd like to put the same question, if I may, to you. Other than leveling Lebanese apartment buildings with families inside of them, annihilating other Lebanese infrastructure, including hospitals, medical facilities, sewage plants, a lot very similar to what the regime has done Gaza, although on a much smaller scale, leading up to this ceasefire, going after UNESCO World Heritage sites in Baalbek, in Tyre, in Beirut, in a true military, from a true military and political perspective, the Israeli regime, how did it fare? How do you gauge its level of success in achieving any of its stated objectives on Lebanese soil?
Look, if we stop talking about all the propaganda of objectives that are put forward in the media and analyze really what is the main objective of the Zionist colony, we will realize that this is a colonial project. And in order for a colony to continue existing, it has to eradicate the indigenous peoples. This is true in the Canada, in the United States, in Australia, and any colonial project that cannot eradicate the indigenous people fails, as happened in Algeria, as happened in South Africa. So right now, before the October 7th Al-Aqsa flood began, already the Palestinian people as a population inside historic Palestine, they had returned to being the majority within the borders of that historical Palestine. So it was the imperative was for the Zionists to eradicate, to genocide. That is their main military objective. And similarly in Lebanon, the objective is to break the will of the people in Lebanon. It doesn't matter for them anything else. As long as there's a Lebanese civilian that keeps their head high and refuses to accept the Zionist colony, then the Zionist colony is in trouble and will continue to have people resisting it. Therefore, if we leave all the propaganda out there for the last year aside and just think about those objectives, we will see that in Gaza, at least, it seems that the Zionists are achieving their goal, which is to genocide the Palestinian people. In Lebanon, they have yet to achieve their goal, which is to break the will of the Lebanese people and their solidarity with the Palestinian people. Therefore, ultimately, the war on Lebanon did not succeed. Their objectives did not succeed in Lebanon. Yes, they genocided, they killed, they destroyed, but they did not break the will of the Lebanese people. And tomorrow, there will be more Lebanese people born that will be resisting the Zionist colony.
Laith, let me understand what you're saying. What you're saying, to colonize the indigenous people of Lebanon, like they have done with with the Palestinian people, when you're saying try to break the will of the Lebanese people, to what objective? To break the will of the Lebanese people to one day try to occupy Lebanon? Is that what you're saying?
No. So that Lebanon would not stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. You see, the Palestinian people are just a small part of the bigger Arabic culture. It's also a small part of the greater Syria culture. And as long as there is people in greater Syria and in the Arabic populace or the Muslim nation or Muslim ummah that still stand with the Palestinian people, the Zionist colony will not be safe. This is why we see the genocide being implemented inside Gaza. This is why the attempt to break the will of the Arabic people and people in greater Syria. And this is why the West has been trying to birth a new Muslim in the Wahhabi cult that accepts the Zionist in our midst, that kills other Muslims that fight America and fight the Western imperialists. This is the main project of the Zionist and the imperialist. And up until now, it's 100 years that this project has failed. And as long as we can continue making sure that this project doesn't succeed, there is no hope for the Zionist colony amongst our peoples here in this land.
Thank you, Laith. And Ali, I'm going to come back to you now. Ali, we saw the Zionists jump at this opportunity. You mentioned they got to work, contacted the White House to make this thing happen, make it happen quickly. And it did. Hopefully it'll hold. We will see a ceasefire in Lebanon. Why didn't we see the same kind of level of urgency when it comes to Gaza and all the failed attempts to try to stall on implementing and accepting, even on the best terms, a proposed July deal, by the Biden administration? Why did the leadership in Tel Aviv, why did they stall on putting an end to the bloodshed in Gaza, and what are the ramifications of that?
I think the Gaza ceasefire will be soon and soon enough because the Biden Netanyahu agreements is to ceasefire in Lebanon and ceasefire in Gaza after doing so much massive aggression against the two fronts. And they think that the great reward will be by continuing the era deal or the deal of the era. And after granting Israel the entity, Zionist entity, Golan Heights, and part or moving the also the embassy to Al-Quds. Now the new deal is, after doing such aggression and killing and massive destruction against Lebanon and Gaza, there is no one to support West Bank when is granted and rewarded to the Israeli entity. I think this is the main goal now. They are going to it. You will see a ceasefire in Gaza soon. And I think, but the problem is, there is a new problem going on in United States. All what they want to do is massive killing with Biden and then continue the deal with Trump. The problem is even the Israelis are using the lobbies, AIPAC, Contact S, and Jensen in United States, but they are not convincing anymore. After what they did in Gaza and Lebanon, maybe the whole era deal will not be happening soon because of such killing, massacres, and they cannot heal all those crimes that Benjamin Netanyahu did against Gaza and Lebanon. And as we see, even the people of the Zionist entity, they have no confidence returning to their settlements in the north, while the displaced Lebanese patriots returned last night directly after the ceasefire declaration.
And I'd like to get your take on that too, Laith, if I could. Do you share Ali's optimism that this ceasefire in Lebanon could be possibly a precursor or a prelude to a Gaza ceasefire, or do you have a different perspective on this?
I am not sure this will happen. But obviously, if we look at the speech by Benjamin Netanyahu last night declaring the ceasefire in Lebanon, he threatened the president of Syria, President Assad, and threatened Syria as a whole, and said that they are preparing for war against Iran. He mentioned that they are running out of munitions and their soldiers were tired. So what we can understand from this 60-day ceasefire is that they are waiting for Trump to come into power. And when Trump comes into power, he will be attempting to end the war in Ukraine so he can concentrate on attacking the Axis of Resistance and Iran specifically. So I think we are right now in a waiting period. Members of the Axis of Resistance, Hezbollah, Yemen, Iran, Iraq, Syria, and the Palestinians should all be preparing for the all-out war that Trump is going to come with. This is not going to be a very long ceasefire. I may be sounding pessimistic. I may be ruining the moment for a lot of people that are watching us today. But I think the coming of Trump and those words from Netanyahu tell us that we are going for a bigger war. So all the Axis of Resistance should be preparing for this. Yes, today we celebrate the ceasefire, this temporary ceasefire in Lebanon, but everybody should be ready for what's coming next. And Trump is going to allow Netanyahu to do even more things than the genocide committed in Gaza that Biden allowed him to do.
And I'm going to kind of go on a different tangent, Mr. Ahamia. The developments we saw, Israel's actions in Gaza, Lebanon, and oftentimes in Syria over the past 14 months, we've seen dozens upon dozens of protests with respect to Netanyahu and his cabinet in Israeli-occupied Palestine on the streets. People didn't like the way that this particular cabinet was handling the war. We saw a lot of divisions within the cabinet itself. How do you gauge today Israel's health, both politically and socially, as a result of the developments over the last 14 months?
We have to see the conclusion of their strategy and their main goal in what they did as imperative aggression against Lebanon and against Gaza. And they were prepared for it like 6 months before the 7th of October last year. We see at Akutori, Cyprus, they were prepared for kind of demonstrations how to attack Gaza and demolish Gaza, how to defeat Hezbollah, and how to deal with Iran in case they it entered that war. So they were prepared against that. And then the 7th of October came suddenly, and let's say confused them in this case. I think that they still moving forward for the new deal, as I said, with the Trump. As we saw that yesterday, Benjamin Netanyahu speech, he mentioned seven fronts, and he mentioned Judea and Samaria. Why he mentioned the same sentence as Donald Trump did before? And where is the seventh front? The seventh front, as we know, there is six fronts in the resistance axis, but the seventh one is West Bank. And to continue this, they have to gain West Bank without any resistance, because Lebanon, he's just finished a war with the entity. Gaza will have a ceasefire, and I believe so soon.
Okay.
So they will be, West Bank will be alone, because it's under the Palestinian Authority, which is related to the normalization states in the region.
Mr.
So
Abbey,
nobody will defend them.
I don't mean to cut you off. We only have about 30 seconds left. I really want to get... Leith, we saw the very same opposite, the exact opposite when it comes to the resistance front in the region. We have seen unprecedented unity, solidarity, collaboration, and cooperation in operations in the, with when it comes to the resistance over the past 14 months. 30 seconds or less so we can wrap this up. Go ahead.
Yes, I mean, this coordination has to continue and intensify. The West as a whole, the empire ruled from D.C., is all fighting as one. In fact, the Israeli military command center, there is American generals there that are controlling the actions of the Israeli military. There is no such thing as Israel, really, or its military. They have been defeated. Right now, we're fighting directly against the whole Western empire ruled from D.C., and with it, all the collaborationist regime in the region that are paying the bill for this war. And that's the size of this war. This is not a war about Gaza only. This is a war against American imperialism. And the Axis of Resistance has to raise the level of its coordination and its collaboration to match that of the Western alliance ruled from D.C.
Gentlemen, appreciate having you both on. A pleasure to have you both on. And stay safe to the both of you, Mr. Ali Hamia, academic and political analyst, joining us from Lebanese capital Beirut, and Leith Maarouf, activist and political commentator, joining us out of South Lebanon. And thanks for tuning in. This brings us to the end of this segment of your Spotlight. Bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT-5 and IntelSat-39.